Up next, an interview with retired NASA astronaut Jim Lovell.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with retired NASA astronaut Jim Lovell. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. Jim was born in Cleveland, Ohio on March 25th of 1928. He attended the University of Wisconsin and the United States Naval Academy. During his naval career, he had numerous aviator assignments, including a four-year tour as a test pilot at the Naval Air Test Center in Maryland. While there, he was a program manager for the F-4H Phantom fighter. He logged more than 7,000 hours of flying time, more than 3,500 hours in jet aircraft. Captain Lovell flew on four space flights for NASA, most notably Apollo 13. We're speaking with retired NASA astronaut Jim Lovell. Captain, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your service. Does this conversation find you in good health?
Well, so far I'm okay, and my health has been pretty good. I've had the usual problems. I'm now 90 years old, of course, so things happen as you get older.
Jim, how did you become an astronaut?
Well, first of all, you have to go back to from high school. I got an invitation to become a naval aviator through a program called the Holloway Program. It gave me my 2 years of college and my flight training, and then I got to be a naval aviation, and I finally went to test pilot school, and I became a test pilot then for the Navy, doing primarily the F-4 Phantom. And about that time is when the old NACA, turned into NASA, decided to put people into orbit, The Mercury program just started in 1958. I was one of the 110 selectees for the Mercury program. It got down to 30 selectees, and I went to my physical, and I was the only guy to flunk that physical. So I didn't make the Mercury program, but it turned out that I was asked again to come in, and I got into the program about I think it was about 1961, 62, the Gemini program.
Your first flight was on Gemini 7. Now, do you say Gemini or Gemini? Please correct me.
They're both right. Depends on which way you want to say it, either Gemini or Gemini.
Okay. Well, I've always said Gemini. Your first flight was on Gemini 7 in December of 65. That mission included a rendezvous with Gemini 6. How did that idea come along?
Well, one of the things we needed to do in the Gemini program to prepare for Apollo, which included rendezvous and docking, in Gemini we wanted to prove out whether that was possible or whether people could handle it. And it turned out that Gemini 6, which was to take off before 7, it was going to rendezvous with the Agena. And the Agena had a docking facility on board. So Gemini 6 was going to take off with them, and then Gemini 7 was going to follow for the two-week mission. Well, the Agena got lost on the launch, and so Gemini 6 didn't have anything to rendezvous with. So consequently, the events occurred that Gemini 7 took off for its two-week mission, and after about 8 or 9 days in orbit, then Gemini 6 was going to rendezvous with Gemini 7. No docking, but at least the rendezvous would take place. That was very successful. And so then Gemini 6 came up, rendezvoused, then departed. Gemini 7 finished his 14-day mission.
It must have been pretty exciting to tag team with another manned spacecraft for a while. Were you close enough to see the other crew in their windows?
Oh, yeah. We're within just a foot of each other. We could see very clearly into the window of Gemini 6. And on that flight in Gemini 7, there was a West Pointer and Frank Borman and a Naval Academy guy, me. In Gemini 6, there were two Naval Academy guys, Wally Schirra, Tom Stafford. And so when the two vehicles got very close together, nose to nose, Tom Stafford put up a sign that said, "Beat Army," and I took the picture.
That's something not everybody reads about in the history books. A two-week flight with a new milestone. It was a new milestone at the time. How did you pass the time with Colonel Borman?
Well, actually, 2 weeks, the thing that saved us is zero gravity because we float. So if I was sitting on that seat like I would be sitting on a chair on Earth, I don't think I could spend 2 weeks sitting on a chair. And so the zero gravity provided the way to do it. We actually did quite well towards the end of our flight. The fuel cells were starting to fail, and Frank kind of wanted to come down early, but I think that we were able to keep up for the whole two weeks.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired astronaut Jim Lovell. Your second flight was on Gemini 12 with Buzz Aldrin. I've read that after this final launch of the Gemini Titan, that the tower was immediately torn down. What were your thoughts of the space program at that flight as the Apollo project was gearing up?
Well, of course, progress is the name of the game. And after Gemini 12, which proved out to be very successful, about a four-day mission and how we learned to work outside the spacecraft, and we practiced by large water tanks that we could practice in simulating zero gravity. But after the Gemini program was stopped, we were all looking forward to Apollo and working that way.
Your next mission was very aggressive on Apollo 8, the first manned flight to orbit the moon. Was the space race against the Soviet Union a factor in your mission profile?
The space race between the Soviets and the Americans was actual, very actual. We had information that the Soviets were going to put a man around the moon in December of 68. As a matter of fact, that was quite true. They had sent unmanned spacecraft around before to test it. And so we had information that they were going to do that in December. And so we tried to speed up our return using only the command module, command service module, to go around the moon. And fortunately, everything worked out fine. The spacecraft was in good shape. And we actually couldn't have launched on a better day. We orbited by Christmas. And we were able to read the first 10 verses of Genesis from the Old Testament to the people back on Earth. Bill Anders took a great picture called Earthrise, which gave in one photograph a good indication of where all the people on the Earth were living. So I was very happy to be part of that program.
Were you really prepared for that first manned ride on a Saturn V, and how did it feel?
Yeah, the Saturn V was the first time that men had gone on it, and it had a couple of failures before, but it worked perfectly this time. And then and I was the navigator for the flight, so well, that worked. That was the first for that operation, too.
Your thoughts as you were on the far side of the moon, knowing that no person had ever seen that far side of the moon, what were your thoughts looking at that?
Well, we were the first people to see live the far side of the moon. We had some pictures of it just before we took off. But it was for the highlight, I think, of my space career. And as we came around and on the near side again, I saw some old craters that I knew quite well. As a matter of fact, there was a little mountain that I named for my wife, Mount Maryland, which now is officially recognized by the International Astronomical Association as a name on the near side of the moon.
That's incredible. Was that Marilyn that I spoke with an hour ago?
Yes, you spoke to my wife, and
well,
she's very proud that there's a mountain named Mount Merrill after her.
Well, I'm honored to have spoken with her as well. Everyone knows about Apollo 13, so I'll just graze on that mission because you've spoken so much about it over the years. After the oxygen tank explosion, how quickly was the data rushing into you, if there was data at all, and when did you know something was really wrong besides seeing the O2 gauges, the oxygen gauges?
Well, it didn't take much time after the explosion to figure out that something was really wrong, because I got down from the lunar module back in the command module and saw that two of our fuel cells have just died. A fuel cell is a device where we took liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen to combine them and got water and electrical power. And that meant that we couldn't land on the moon because we lost two out of three fuel cells. One fuel cell would give us home, but that would be just about it. But then when I looked out the side window and saw gaseous oxygen spewing out of the rear end of my spacecraft, I realized we were in more trouble than I originally thought, because with the gas still going out, my third fuel cell would die. We'd have no electrical power. I couldn't use the engines at all, and we lose all of our oxygen. And of course, we were breathing oxygen, so we had to use the lunar module to see if we could get home.
Well, that had to be very quick, and I mean, I just can't imagine the stress that was going on at that moment. And based on that stress, can you actually remember your world famous quote? Was it, "Houston, we've had a problem," or "Houston, we have a problem"?
As best I can remember, I think it was, "Houston, we have had a problem. We have a main B bus undervolt."
I've heard the recordings, and because they're somewhat distorted over, you know, the distance of space, it's not completely clear. But I had to ask that of you. That's kind of,
well, you know, it's been 50 years, so almost I've forgotten it too.
Of all the challenges that followed on your flight, enduring a very cold ride back to Earth, how did you folks stay warm? I mean, what did you do to not have hypothermia?
Well, we were in our in-flight suits, but that didn't help much. The temperature got down to about around 36 degrees. And yeah, it got quite cold. We just stuffed it out, and we didn't want to get up in our pressure suits because the interiors were lined. Of course, the first part of the suit was rubber, and that would cause us to sweat inside the suit and then freeze on the outside, and that didn't sound too good, so we didn't put our suits on.
How accurate do you think the movie was that portrayed your flight?
The movie, believe it or not, was very accurate. Everything was correct. The only thing that was not correct, and Ron Howard only put it in to sort of enhance the movie a little bit, was the argument between Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert as who threw the switch that we thought, you know, caused the problem.
I spoke with Gene Kranz about a month and a half ago, and I was asking him some questions about that flight. And again, I wanted to stay away from that just because everybody seems to know all the details about it, or, you know, as it were. So now this is the important one that I want to know. What are your recollections of splashing down and then the hatch opening after that wild ride, being so cold and all of a sudden you're in a nice warm ocean?
Yeah, well, you know, 13 after the explosion was one surprise after the other. And it was only when we finally hit the water, I knew that we finally made it home again. And I looked at both the guys and, you know, took their hands, and we then had the interior smelled bad too, but we opened up that hatch and the fresh air from the Pacific came in, and we knew that we were home.
Putting your feet on the deck of an aircraft carrier had to be like going home for you.
Now, that's right. It was. It was very nice to get back. Fred Hayes, of course, got sick a couple of days before we got home, and so we immediately put him in sick bay on board the ship until he got well.
Which ship was that? Was that the Hornet?
No, there was Iwo Jima.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because they had to scramble at the last minute because the flight plan was way off to where your trajectory was going to take you to a different part of the world.
Yeah, we had to figure out. There were some calls of whether we're going to go to the Atlantic or someplace else, and we finally did get someplace near where we were supposed to be in the Pacific.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with Captain Jim Lovell, retired NASA astronaut. You've had a multifaceted career since retiring from the Navy and NASA. How do you keep busy these days?
Well, I've done, of course, right after I left, I got it myself on the speaking business. But then I sort of retired from that. And I'm on several boards. I'm on the Adler Planetarium here in Chicago, which has my Gemini 12 spacecraft as a display. I'm also on the board of the National Museum of the American Sailor. The Great Lakes Naval Station up here is near my home, and that's where all the enlisted sailors are getting trained for the Navy. And we're now in the process of trying to raise funds to build a museum in their honor.
I've saved the last and most important question for last. What's your favorite food, and what do you want for Christmas?
Well, I tell you what, let me see. I love scrambled eggs. You say scrambled eggs. My wife makes scrambled eggs for me almost every day.
What do you want for Christmas?
Well, Christmas has gone by. I don't know if I hope I make the next one. I think I just want to have a wife that's still, healthy and can be with me.
Well, Captain, thank you so much for your time. It's been an honor speaking with you. From myself, now, I'm retired Air Force, but I know the Navy thing. Well done. And from Sun Sounds of Arizona, Godspeed in your endeavors.
Thank you very much, and have a good year.
An interview with retired NASA astronaut Jim Lovell. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We now check in for current news of NASA.
Views of Home. Presented by Science at NASA. In 1968, Apollo 8 placed humans into lunar orbit for the first time. As the astronauts and their spacecraft emerged from behind the moon, they were surprised and enchanted by an amazing view of Earth rising over the lunar horizon. Bill Anders quickly snapped a picture of the spectacular Earthrise. Humankind viewed their planet and saw not a jigsaw puzzle of states and countries on an uninspiring flat map, but rather a whole planet, uninterrupted by boundaries, a sphere of dazzling beauty floating alone in the void. Cameras on NASA spacecraft have treated us to intriguing perspectives of our home planet from various locales. The Deep Space Climate Observatory, or DISCOVER mission, was launched to monitor the solar wind in real time, but it has also delivered these wondrous images of every continent peeking out from misty shrouds blanketing our ultramarine oceans. Since mid-2015, DISCOVER has been snapping images like these of the fully lit Earth most days every 1 to 2 hours, from a stable point between the Earth and the Sun that is about 1 million miles or 1.6 million kilometers away. On Valentine's Day 1990, the Voyager spacecraft captured this photo of our planet from the amazing distance of 3.7 billion miles or 6 billion kilometers. This pale blue dot image, requested by Carl Sagan of the Voyager imaging team, showed the Earth as a single pixel and inspired Sagan's book of the same name. As Sagan wrote, "The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. This distant image of our tiny world underscores our responsibility to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known." A number of spacecraft have taken the opportunity to capture images and videos of Earth and the Moon when flying by Earth for a gravity assist to far-off bodies in our solar system. Galileo did so in 1992 on its way to Jupiter, as did Juno nearly 2 decades later. In 2005, Messenger took these beautiful images of our home, then looked back again just before entering Mercury's orbit 5 years later. Messenger isn't the only spacecraft to look back at home from its destination across the solar system. On July 19, 2013, NASA's Cassini spacecraft slipped into Saturn's shadow and turned to image the planet, seven of its moons, its inner rings, and in the background, our home planet. NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO, has collected a treasure trove of data and discoveries about the moon. LRO's camera also treated us to spectacular views of our planet from lunar orbit. Here's one such image taken in October 2015. Images of home have come back to us from Mars orbit and from the surface of Mars itself. The High-Resolution Imaging Science Experiment, or HIRISE, on NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter took this picture of our planet and its moon on November 20, 2016, when Mars was 127 million miles, or about 200 million kilometers, away from Earth. This image, captured by NASA's Curiosity Mars rover from the surface of Mars on January 31, 2014, showed evening star Earth shining more brightly than any star in the Martian night sky. From the vantage point of Mars, Earth is visible either in the early evening or early morning, just as Venus is from the vantage point of Earth. What might the caption be when a human stands on the surface of Mars and focuses the camera back on home? America's debut in space, Explorer 1. Presented by Science at NASA. On January 31st, 1958, the United States joined the space race with the successful launch of the Explorer 1 satellite. But the event was much more than a rocket launch. Geopolitically, it leveled the Cold War playing field with the Soviet Union, which had sent Sputnik into orbit 4 months earlier. Scientifically, the launch of Explorer 1 represented the first time humans sent instruments into space, including a modified Geiger counter for tracking radiation, to collect data and relay it back to Earth. And historically, it led us into an infinite new frontier that has yielded data, images, and wonders never before imagined. University of Iowa physicist James Van Allen, who designed and ran the science experiment on Explorer 1 and experiments on myriad subsequent missions, called the event one of the landmarks in the technical and scientific history of the human race. He continued, "Its instrumentation revealed the existence of radiation belts of the Earth and opened up a massive new field of scientific exploration in space. It inspired an entire generation of young men and women in the United States to higher achievement and propelled the Western world into the space age." Jim Green, NASA's planetary science director, was among those who were inspired as a student and protege of Van Allen's at Iowa.
Dr. Van Allen was a pioneer of the space age, and the results from his Explorer 1 instrument marked the birth of space science. The discovery of the radiation belts encircling the Earth was a game changer for space exploration. Space was no longer thought to be empty, and for that, the man and the mission will long be remembered.
Spacecraft en route to Earth orbit or deep space must dash through the Van Allen belts, donut-shaped regions of charged particles trapped by Earth's magnetic field. The high-energy particles can batter spacecraft and even interfere with onboard instruments. To ensure the safety and health of astronauts and space science missions, scientists have been uncovering vital information about the radiation belts ever since Explorer 1 discovered them. In a speech at Cornell University on March 3, 1965, then NASA Administrator James Webb explained the critical importance of success in the vast new horizon of space. "The mastery of a new environment or of a major new technology or the combination of the two, as we now see in space, has always in the past had the most profound effects on all nations and on all the peoples of the Earth. In the modern world, basic knowledge applied through technology is a source of national power." Former NASA chief historian Stephen Dick summarized the impact of Explorer 1's launch. One could hardly have known what this singular event would set off during the next 60 years. Like the railroad and the airplane, spaceflight has impacted society in ways even the visionaries could not have foreseen, and that we cannot fully fathom even today. The drive for discovery that enabled the success of Explorer 1 endures today at NASA. The agency's innovative spacecraft continue to find new ways to observe and understand the interconnected systems of our home planet, as well as help us see beyond our solar system into worlds we can explore as one. For more on amazing advancements in space science, visit science.nasa.gov.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you. All of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.